everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to another We're Not Here episode of Make Me Smart. You don't see us. We're not here. I closed my eyes just now, so you can't see me. We are actually spending some time exploring themes from the first season as we get rolling for season two. We're figuring out new ways for all of us to get smarter together.
It is the hiatus that's only kind of a hiatus. We're looking back at our conversations about the state of the internet this week.
Yeah, and first, though, you've been sending us great emails about what you want to hear from season two, and we don't want to get a backlog, and we have been reading them, so we thought we would share a few.
Item number one, Frances Ferguson. She writes, quote, "I do miss the news fix," end of quote, amen, sister.
Ditto.
But it's tricky, right? I mean, you know, we can go into it, but the name of the game is you can't do a news fix on a weekly podcast. You just, you kind of can't, because...
I disagree.
Okay, well, I guess we'll have that little fight, won't we? Samantha Longshore also wants the news fixed back, and she writes, "I enjoy hearing about things that may not be receiving a lot of coverage, but Kai and Molly think it's important, and then I become informed and less slips through unknown."
See?
End of quote. I get that. Yes. All right, fine.
Okay, actually, no, but this is a really good point. What do you guys think? How do you listen to our show? Because this will help us decide. Right. What happened is we thought if we do a news fix every week, the news is out of date by the time we get to it on Tuesday.
Right.
It's, you know, already because we live every day twice these days. And B, if you want to listen to it months later, then you get a news fix at the top and it doesn't make any sense for you.
Right.
And we've been trying to figure out how to solve that question. And basically, we could use your help.
And let's remember, there have been at least a couple of shows where the news changed as we were doing the news fix.
In the taping.
So, you know.
Yeah. It's tricky. Anyway. I'm not going to lie. It's tricky. Yeah. A lot of you also wrote in about Kai's paternity leave story because we were all equally horrified. Carrie Sykes writes in and says, "I was struck by Kai's story about bringing your newborn son to work with you because you were denied paternity leave. The small town I live in just barely passed paid family leave for town employees. I was hoping you could discuss the economic impacts of paid parental leave. I consider it a timely topic. New York just enacted it statewide. And I definitely think it is an issue that directly fits into the category of moral capitalism."
Yeah, it totally is. And to be clear here, I was complicit, right? I mean, I was an eager beaver and I wanted more time in front of the microphone. And so I said, sure. But yeah, okay. Anyway, keep on sending us your thoughts about what we should or should not be doing in season two. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Wait, somebody hit me with the date. When are we coming back? March. Producer Jenny says March. Okay. We did get a lot of emails over the past year about the state of the internet.
The state of the internet, because somebody wisely pointed out at CES this year, which I was not at for the first time in like a newly formed adult amount of time.
Is that right? Really?
I think this would have been, yeah. I mean, I've been going since 2000. Like, I think this would have been my 18th CES.
Oh my God. How come what happened? How come you didn't
I'm like know? Not old enough to have that many. Well, the great, it, my coverage priorities have changed. Let me put it that way. And CES is, as one of our producers put it kind of brilliantly, a really large press conference.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
And that, you know, since my focus is much more on the business of technology and the stories that aren't being told, it didn't feel as relevant. And frankly, it ended up, I think, feeling even more trivial than it ever has. And part of the reason is because, as I think Scott Stein from CNET said during one of their live broadcast, which of course I streamed because like I needed to know what was happening. But he said, you know, here's these companies and they're just happily trotting out all their stuff. And the zeitgeist is like Black Mirror.
Yeah.
Everybody's
totally
suspicious.
Totally.
You know, and upset. And yeah, so the real tech story of 2017 is people starting to freak out about internet and security and government privacy.
So having now streamed some of the coverage, did you think you had to know what was going on there, or were you okay being a member of the lay public like most of us and saying, oh, yeah, it's a convention in Vegas. The lights went out, I guess, right?
I mean, that gave me FOMO. I'm not going to lie. When the lights went out, that was the one time that I was wishing that I was there because that's like a cool story.
Yeah, okay.
But that tells you all you need to know about everything else.
Right. There you go.
Came
okay.
out of it.
All right.
pretty much.
Yeah, totally. All right. So back in March, episode 3, it says here in my notes, we talk with Tim Wu, the guy widely credited with inventing the phrase. Back in March, we should just leave that in. Back in March, episode 3, we talked with a guy by the name of Tim Wu. He is, I think, a Columbia, right? Isn't he a Columbia? Yeah, he's at Columbia, also widely credited with inventing the phrase net neutrality. So we called him up, and really, we've been having that conversation about net neutrality kind of since March.
We really have. And about the internet and the way it works and what it should be doing for us and what it's doing to us. And that led to another really interesting conversation about internet privacy with Fordham professor Joel Rydenburg. That was in episode 13, which also features this immortal quote. I'm so glad we're not letting this one die from Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner.
You know, again, you know, nobody's got to use the internet.
Nobody's got to use it. Yeah. You could totally be fine in life without the internet.
You know,
you don't need electricity. After that episode, we got an email from one of the two commissioners of the FTC, Terrell McSweeney. She also wanted to talk about internet privacy. And we ended up talking a lot about the limits of the FTC's enforcement powers as they pertain to the internet. That was in episode 20. And that, because of the rollback of the 2015 net neutrality rules, is about to become a really big deal in 2018 because the agency now in charge of making sure the internet doesn't screw you is the FTC.
Right. After the FCC's decision to let the FCC handle. Anyway, it's a big bureaucratic blah, blah, blah. Two conversations, though, that kind of summed up our year in the internet and which honestly are going to be as relevant in the year to come. And they are coming up after we pay the bills.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more, Wondery means business.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk, to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.
Back in May, we had a conversation with Zeynep Tufekci. She's the author of Twitter and Tear Gas, The Power and Fragility of Networked Protests. And if you're looking for some good outrage Twitter, it's Zeynep.
She's it.
Like, she is, you'll get a little mad reading her tweets, you know, and then you'll have to go calm down and like knit or whatever, which is what I do to recover from Twitter. But
are you a knitter?
I have turned into such a knitter too. Like, it's got, I think it's my new meditation because now I'm really obsessed with it and I keep buying all these fiddly little things and I'm making like a pom-pom beanie. I'm old. Anyway,
when we
talked to Zeynep, I don't even know who I am anymore. I don't even know, but it makes me feel good and it calms me down. So okay, I'm into it. Mm-hmm. When we talked to Zeynep, we talked about the dangers of consolidation in newspapers and local television stations, how we're getting inundated with this fire hose of information all the time, true and otherwise. And we started just, you know, chatting like you do about the merger between Sinclair and Tribune, a deal that is still under consideration by the FCC. So I know we could talk to you about roughly 1 million topics just based on your Twitter feed alone, but we want to talk to you about information flow. I saw this great thread that you wrote post kind of some of the news about the Sinclair Tribune merger, which we want to get into, but also about what is happening in local news. So in the context of that landscape, when you see this potential merger like Sinclair and Tribune, what do you see happening?
Well, it worries me even more because what little local news we have left is also becoming increasingly consolidated and coming under the control of a group that we know to be, you know, terribly ideological. And it would really consolidate the information flows. And we're seeing this online already, right? We have Facebook and Google that are chomping up so much of the ad money. And we have increasing numbers of people who get their news through those sources. And in local news, whenever I travel around the country or when I look at where I live at North Carolina, we see layoff after layoff in what's left of independent newspapers. And we're seeing it's just harder to learn what's happening in your own hometown.
How do you then adjust for the fact that there is what feels like so much news? There's a fire hose thing that is beyond my experience going on right now.
Well, that's actually exactly why we need more filters. Fire hose is an effect of filter failure. Our gatekeepers are kind of going bankrupt. And while they may not have been perfect, they did a useful function. And we don't have new institutions that have replaced them, or have we found ways to finance them. So basically, we're relying on Facebook's algorithm to rank things for us and Google search to sort things for us. And that's not a great gatekeeping mechanism. There's a lot of issues if that's the way you're filtering the way society gets information.
But wouldn't Sinclair say, that's why we want Tribune? Don't Verizon and Yahoo say, in consolidation, there is funding, that then there's money for journalism?
In consolidation, there is funding cuts. When they say there is funding, what they mean is they're going to cut the funds that support the diverse ecology and therefore be cheaper. And that's what you do, right? You consolidate the newsrooms and you sort of have fewer people reporting stuff and you have decimation in local news. They're either being bought by a few ideological operators or people are getting laid off in large numbers. And what happens then is, you know, you need somebody to follow what's happening at the city council. You need somebody to know who the deals are going to at the local level. And if you don't do that, a lot of local stuff gets corrupted. Contracts go to relatives or, you know, and things happen that shouldn't happen. All the things that you read about in corrupt countries start happening more and more in the United States. I want local news. I don't see that being done on the cheap. And that's the problem. That's the crisis.
So what we have here is a company doing what a company is supposed to do, right? Increase its market share, buy more, get bigger, and make more money. We have a government, a Republican government, right, doing what Republican governments typically do, which is let market forces take the lead and provide a lighter regulatory hand, as we've seen with the Sinclair thing and Ajit Pai and the FCC and all of that. Where does the responsibility fall on consumers in that environment, right? Because news consumers like to hear people that they agree with.
Right. So a couple of things here. One of them is that this isn't any player. This is a very ideologically conservative player that has been known to try to influence, have its influence on elections and other politics by pushing its own particular point of view.
Sinclair, you
which
mean?
Is obviously, you know, I'm not a Sinclairist, right? It's very conservative and it has a history of pushing conservative views and campaigning almost openly against some candidates. Mm-hmm. And that wouldn't be a problem in a diverse marketplace where there are a lot of choices, right? But it's a problem if they're going to be the only news source in 200 markets. And I'd like to say I'd have the same worry even if it was some other viewpoint, like having one viewpoint mm-hmm. control so mm-hmm. much of media is a problem, especially when you know it's an ideologically aggressive group that they try to impose their viewpoint on news very strongly.
So Sinclair,
so the second thing.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So the second thing I would say is that there are a lot of markets where it makes sense for businesses to consolidate in order to kill the market, right? So I wouldn't say this is the market working with a light hand. I would say this is more like the monopoly tendencies that always creep up if you don't beat back. So there's this misunderstanding that if you just let things be, the markets work. But as you can see from, say, Facebook or Google, if you let things be, you can have an anti-market. You can have a few big companies end up killing competition to the degree there's no viable competition left anymore and there's no way to catch up because the entry is so expensive.
Well, it's interesting, too, because I think in the earlier days of what we used to call the World Wide Web and now just apparently call the Internet, the counterargument would be, well, we have the Internet. we have all of these sources of information that we can access at any time on our phone. Is the consolidation of power by Google and Facebook a problem? Is the dissemination of misinformation, you know, helping or hurting the cause of information flow?
I think it's all related. I think we're seeing once again that there are strong centralization tendencies on the internet. And there are reasons for that. It's network effects. Everybody's on Facebook, so you go on Facebook. Or, you know, Google has all the data, so it searches better, which is going to feed on itself. I mean, obviously, those companies do good products too. But what happens is once they get past the point, they almost can't be caught up. Mm-hmm. And I think information flows is a pretty significant one where we should have multiple players, many players, because unlike shoes, if all the shoes in the world are produced by one company, maybe, you know, we just don't get some interesting styles and I can live with that. But if all the local news in most of the country is controlled by a very aggressive, ideologically determined operator, that's a different problem.
Before we let you go, we want to ask you our Make Me Smart question. This is our sort of signature question that we ask everybody who comes on the show, mm-hmm. which is...
Oh, wait, I didn't prepare.
You don't have to.
Oh, no, you don't have to prepare.
Right. It
is drawn
way.
From your wealth of personal experience. What is something you thought you knew, but you were wrong about? You later found out you were wrong about.
I mean, I have a 10-mile long list.
Most of us do.
So when the internet first came, I was pretty certain that censorship would become very hard. And that was when I was, you know, many years ago, and I grew up in Turkey, right? So in the 90s. And actually, I hadn't figured out that information overload could be a form of censorship. I grew up under information restriction as the form of censorship, and it just hadn't occurred to me because I'd never experienced it because, I, you know, scarcity was the way to go. I ran out of books. I ran out of newspapers. I ran out of things to read or learn. I didn't realize that you could flood people with information so much that you would confuse them and that would effectively function as censorship. And that's something that I think we're seeing more of, and that's something I learned in the past, you know, few years.
All right, so here is a different conversation, one that I had with Max Reed in October about an article he wrote in New York Magazine. It was titled, "Does Even Mark Zuckerberg Know What Facebook Is?" Because honestly, Facebook at the center of a whole lot of stuff in this country the past year, 18 months. One thing to know about this before you hear it, when we talked about the German elections, those happened. Angela Merkel was reelected chancellor. And as you might know, since that conversation, she has since formed a coalition government, just as a side little Benny of the news. But I started by asking Max why he wanted to write about Facebook.
So the genesis of this piece was this tour that Mark Zuckerberg has been taking across the country. He at the beginning of the year, he set a personal challenge for himself to have visited every state before the end of the year. And so, you know, we sort of set off to do a kind of a regular magazine piece that was just, what's he up to? What's he doing? And as we started to research it and report it out, it became clear that we didn't really have the language or the terms to talk about what exactly he was up to. It was very easy to say, you know, oh, he's presaging a presidential run. But Facebook is such a weird company and such an enormous company that it didn't really seem adequate to say, you know, oh, he wants to be president, or even to say, you know, oh, you know, he already has as much power as a president, because saying something like that is a kind of crazy thing to say. And so we decided the best way to do it was to ask the question, you know, if we don't know what Facebook is, are we sure that Mark Zuckerberg knows what it is?
Do we think Zuckerberg knows what it is? I mean, he's got some ideas. He's written a manifesto that you talk about in this piece called Building a Global Community. It runs like 6,000 words. So he's clearly got some thoughts on what it is he's trying to do here.
Yeah, I mean, I think he has a perspective on Facebook. I think we all do. I think what's kind of difficult to talk about is that it's so big that my given perspective, my sense of what it is as I use it, is different from someone else's. And it's not just that I, as a user, have a different perspective. It's that the U.S. government as an institution or a body has a different perspective, as charities that use it, as political parties that use it. Each one of them uses it in different ways and thinks about it in different ways. So I think Zuckerberg knows what it is in a bunch of different senses. But I don't think that any one of us right now can really sort of grasp it in its totality, just because of its size.
There was a piece in, we're taping this on a Thursday. There was a piece, I think, in the New York Times today in which there was either a quote or this was the point of the op-ed is Facebook too big to be regulated? I mean, I'm skipping ahead a little bit here in this conversation, but one of the things that's been happening as a result of the Russian involvement in the election, and as a result, frankly, of Zuckerberg and Facebook's intransigence in coming clean about what they know about Russian involvement in Facebook in this election, that's one of the things that's gotten them in trouble. Is it possible to regulate this company, to wrap our arms around this company in a way that it will not just do what it wants willy-nilly, which is what it's been doing so far?
Sure. I mean, I would say technically, absolutely, it's possible to regulate Facebook, you know, but it also requires the political will to do so. It requires some creative, legal, and regulatory thinking about what Facebook is and how it could best be regulated. You know, from the perspective of the Russian ads problem, that's a problem where there already is a significant body of regulatory law about how we deal with political ads on broadcast networks, that it would be relatively simple to sort of shift over to the internet. You know, in particular, the idea that foreign governments can't purchase political ads. Mm. But sort of the broader problem of bringing 2 billion people together in ways that the planet has never really experienced before, I'm not sure that we have yet thought through the consequences of what that is, and therefore, you know, how best to regulate it or deal with it. Mm. It's not like Ma Bell, where you just break it up into 5 regional pieces. It's not like broadcasters, where you just put some really stringent rules about what can and can't be said on it. So it's that combination of sort of thinking through what Facebook is in order to figure out what to do about it, and then also making sure that there actually is a political will to do it among users and citizens and politicians.
You know, but you point out in this piece that Facebook now is, in essence, a transnational actor, right? It has almost the powers of a sovereign. Mm-hmm. It has, and these are your words, this is a great phrase, it's got planetary technical systems, right? I mean, think about that.
Yeah.
It seems to me to be so gargantuan and ginormous that because your experience is different than my experience is different than, you know, anybody else's experience, that adds a layer of complexity that is almost insurmountable.
Yeah. And I think I think it's one of the major challenges of the 21st century is figuring out how these planetary technical systems, of which Facebook is just one, you know, Google is another one, Amazon and Apple both sort of approach that size and that scope, how the kind of the states that we recognize as the main sovereign entities on the planet grapple with those and with the consequences of them. You know, and I try to be optimistic as hard as it is in 2017. You know, the U.S. government still has the army and the nuclear arsenal. So at least Facebook doesn't have that yet. Servers are still mostly located in the U.S. Like physically, the U.S. government has the power to take on Facebook if it needs to. It's really a matter of grasping this as a problem and addressing it. And you know, where it's easy to get pessimistic is if you wake up every day and you open Facebook on your phone, what you see is like a collection of your friends and, right, and birthday reminders and stuff. And it's difficult to think about that in terms of something that might genuinely be a threat to an open liberal democratic society.
About that liberal democratic society, you write here that after the election, Zuckerberg was amazed at the wreckage that his invention had brought to liberal democratic society. And he initially was extremely skeptical of his company's impact.
Yeah, you know, I don't know Zuckerberg well. I can't speak to what's in his head, but he definitely, I think, has trouble thinking through the negative consequences of what Facebook does, because in part just because as the CEO, he has to be a true believer in it being a force for good in the world. And I think part of this tour and part of his evolving set of statements about it over the last year has been him slowly sort of publicly coming to terms with the idea that Facebook is not simply, that, you know, that merely connecting people is not enough to be a force for good in the world. That in fact, sometimes connecting people can be bad and can wreck institutions that are necessary for the smooth functioning of civic society.
If we don't understand what Facebook is, and I'm talking the grand we here, and if Mark Zuckerberg specifically doesn't really understand what Facebook hath wrought, what are the consequences? What happens?
Well, I mean, one thing that I've been saying is, you know, as I've been writing in digital media now for 8 or 9 years, and I sort of witnessed Facebook sweep through media around 2011 and 2012. And especially if you were working as a blogger, if you were working in sort of purely digital media, but also in print and everywhere else, Facebook really sort of tore everything up, that it was offering sort of an audience size that we had never really seen before. And a lot of businesses really transformed the way they worked in order to sort of worship at that altar, to suck as much of that audience as they possibly could. And then Facebook decided, sort of by fiat, that it no longer really wanted to work as closely with publications. Mm-hmm. It didn't want to weight links as high on algorithms, and all of a sudden, all that audience disappeared. And you know, to me, that's not a unfamiliar dynamic. I mean, that's not a dynamic. That's a dynamic that could very easily be replicated across all kinds of businesses and institutions. And the one that worries me in particular is the kind of civic fabric of society. So that if Facebook becomes the organizing principle for local community groups, for political parties, for the kinds of, you know, bodies that make up like general daily political life in this country, by offering the sort of organizational tools and the scale that it does, it can really change the way they work. And then if it walks away in some way or changes it or transforms it, you know, it's a little bit like giving Facebook the keys to your church or, mm-hmm. or otherwise giving it a little bit too much power in things that we don't want it to do. You know, what that specifically means, I don't know. It's as with Facebook, I have trouble predicting exactly. I just know that I don't quite trust it to transform the world for good anymore.
Which is a deeply troubling thing to hear from a guy who spent a long time reporting this piece and has thought deeply about this company. What do you suppose happens then in the short to medium term as we continue being politically divided in this country, as Mark Zuckerberg and or Sheryl Sandberg, the chief operating officer of that company, wind up in front of some Senate committee saying, what the hell is going on? And those two say, I don't know, we're just trying to do good and get people to join together in the world. You know?
You know, I think in the short term, I think we will see some real regulatory action, at least around political ads, which I think is a good thing. You know, it's important to set up these kinds of institutional frameworks to deal with this stuff. The question is whether or not that is just, you know, that's the start of a movement to install better regulation across these companies, or whether it's just it's one and done and then they walk away. You know, the latter is sort of the worst case scenario, because that means that Facebook feels like it's been regulated. Facebook feels like it's been dealt with. People hear that Facebook has been dealt with. But the sort of under the churning that goes on underneath the like explicit foreign government interference, which is the sort of hyper-partisan news that pushes news coverage to one pole or the other, and sort of the way it's able to organize groups that otherwise would have trouble organizing offline, that doesn't get dealt with. And that just keeps pushing us into a further part, a more partisan society. It makes elections more difficult to sort of predict and to deal with. And, you know, absent we as a society and theoretically the government that represents us standing up and saying we need to think very carefully about this, there needs to be some kind of public advocacy dealing with this, I don't see why 2016 couldn't be replicated over and over and over again.
You know, that's so interesting. And once again, I'll use this word. It's distressing to hear these words coming out of your mouth, because one of the things you talk about in this piece is Zuckerberg on the 21st-ish of September, when he came back from paternity leave, he did this Facebook Live. It went like 8 or 10 minutes. And he said, listen, I get it. We're going to get better at this. We're going to disclose, blah, blah, blah. And then he said, in almost this language, we are protecting democracy in the upcoming German elections. And which you point out, correctly, is an amazing thing for a private company to say.
Yeah. I mean, it's the thing, what's just as amazing as it saying it is how natural it feels for Facebook to say and think that Facebook understand itself not as a private company, you know, that operates on the field of democracy, but as the field on which democracy itself operates. And it has not demonstrated to us that it can be trusted with that kind of power and responsibility.
What is there a gesture he could make? I mean, just to sort of wrap this up, is there a gesture you think Zuckerberg could make or the company could make that would, and I guess we don't want gestures, right? We want substantive change. What could he do to make people, God, I sound like, I don't even know what I sound like, to make people believe again, you know?
Well, I mean, this is going to be a little bit out there, but I was reading about Charles V last night, who was the Holy Roman Emperor and the King of Spain at the same time.
Charles V, okay.
Yeah. And he was too powerful in the European political sphere. He was at war all the time because he owned all the Spanish colonies. He ruled over the territories that made up the Holy Roman Empire. And he abdicated. You know, he walked away. He gave Spain to his brother and he gave the Holy Roman Empire to his son. And he restored essentially the balance of power on the continent. I'm glossing over it a little bit, but I think the point is that there's precedent for kings stepping down, for people with that kind of power, that kind of sovereign power, saying, you know what, I have too much. I need to walk away. So maybe the version of that I would say Zuckerberg could do that would solve a lot of this is saying, you know what, I'm going to turn Facebook into an enormous nonprofit. I want to bring people together. I want to make them work, but I'm going to do this from the point of view of solely of making the world a better place and not for profit. Yeah. Do I think he's actually going to do that? No. I would be happy if he just released the Russian ads to the public, frankly. But, you know, in my dream world, tomorrow he'd give a speech from the Facebook Vatican and say, Facebook's a nonprofit now.
Oh, Facebook, the conversational topic that never stops giving.
More Facebook.
But in season two, tell us how we can talk about, I mean, I think that we have done a good job of taking these big stories and finding underlying themes and underlying themes that are relevant, you know, in lots of different types of conversations. In season two, I am hoping that we can also come up with stories that aren't the ones that everybody, you know, the same Facebook story that everybody's having, and different news pegs for our connecting the dots. And so I hope you will help us come up with ideas or perspectives that maybe only you have, not you, Kai, but you, listener. So email us. This is the call for the emails, makemesmart@marketplace.org. And in case you're wondering what's happening with our hiatus, we will be back in your feed in another 2 weeks. We're doing a every other week kind of thing, I guess, until March.
Here's one more thing, though, that I personally want to know. What are people's listening habits, right? Do you listen same day that it drops? Do you listen within 24 hours, 48 hours? Do you pile them up? Stuff like that, because that goes back to the top of the conversation, how topical we can be, which, as you might have gathered, Molly and I had different opinions on. I'm just saying.
I know you want to be topical.
Yeah, well, that's true. Yes, but I don't
I'm just
be,
trying
you know,
to find a way for us
wind.
To all get what we want.
Anywho.
But yes. That's it.
Wait, is that,
see you in
is
2 weeks,
that,
everybody.
Is that the music? Wait, I do hear the music, don't I?
There it is.
Do you,
do you have a spiritum liberum right now?
Liberum or librum? Librum?
I don't know. You're the one that took Latin. You're in charge here.
I've told you I failed Latin. We've had that conversation, right?
Oh, shoot.
First quarter.
Who can help us?
First quarter freshman year in college. Got an F in Latin. It's a true story.
Curse this.
Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson and the senior producer, Nancy Fargali. This week's program was engineered by Drew Jostet. Our theme music is composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive director of On Demand here at Marketplace is Satara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager, otherwise known as our boss, is Deborah Clark.
So my Latin teacher's name was Herbert W. Benario. He wore a three-piece wool suit in the summertime in Atlanta, wore his Phi Beta Kappa key on a key fob in his vest. He was about 90 years old, and he failed me in Latin, first quarter freshman year of college.
Dang!
And my GPA 4 years later, by the way, 2.998.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.